Hello, and welcome to Practical Significance, a podcast to inspire listeners with compelling stories from statistics and data science and to propel data-driven careers forward. Here are your hosts, the ASA's Associate Executive Director, Donna Lalonde, and Executive Director, Ron Wasserstein.
Well, welcome, everyone. It's hard to believe that we've made it this far in the year, but Ron and I are super excited to welcome you all back to another episode of Practical Significance. You know, we have something new for our listeners today, a new endeavor for the ASA, a new partnership that we think will be really interesting. And so we're delighted to have Michael join us to talk about InStats. And so, Michael, we're going to start by just asking you to introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about your background and what inspired you to create InStats.
Thank you so much, Donna and Ron, for having me. This is fabulous, and I'm super excited to have a chat about our new partnership among InStats and ASA and describe a little bit about, hopefully, what makes InStats unique and different in the online education space. So just very quickly, a bit about my background. I have a PhD in industrial and organizational psychology, and it was very quantitatively oriented. So that, you know, meant obviously years and years of stats classes and then training in psychometrics, as well as a variety of core quantitative methodologies, including things like meta-analysis, structural equation modeling, hierarchical linear modeling, and obviously, you know, more basically experimental design, research design, et cetera. So one of the things that I always did starting as an undergrad, taking stats classes, was help my peers. So people would come to me with problems they were having because I didn't think it was that difficult. I mean, it was maybe a little annoying periodically. If you're getting an undergraduate degree in psychology, a lot of people, they didn't necessarily like the quantitative aspects of some of the training. But that was always my favorite part, because that was relatively straightforward. You know, there were obvious answers, and the math I didn't think was that hard. It was just, you know, sitting down and learning about, you know, how to design studies, how to answer questions, how to apply various statistical tools to answer those questions. And that just seemed reasonable and logical and et cetera. So very quickly, I just started running these tutoring sessions. And then the stats teacher asked me if I would help out in the lab. And that was my undergrad experience there. And then as the classes, et cetera, progressed and I got to graduate school, it was sort of a similar thing. And then I got a job, my first job in a business school, and the quantitative training there was not at a level that I thought was adequate. And so I started running tutoring sessions and helping people out with primarily PhD students with their dissertations and various projects that they had going on. And over time, what that morphed into was a series of workshops that I started putting on, introducing people to research design, you know, and basic goal analyses. And then that turned into something that we started selling when I was at the University of Melbourne to a global audience. So I would put on week-long workshops. I mean, I sort of cheated a little bit because I'm in Australia. So we did it in February when it's nice and warm down here. And it's quite often very cold for all of you up there in the Northern Hemisphere. So we got people coming in from all over the place. They came in from Eastern Europe and the United States and Canada, et cetera. So they would come down here for a week. We'd have a lot of fun. I would teach various topics, structural equation modeling, hierarchical linear modeling, things that people needed to do their work, but often they were having difficulty learning those methods and applying them on their own. So that was a lot of fun. And then the pandemic hit. And at that point, all forms of traditional teaching got a huge amount of support. As anyone in a university would know, they got a significant amount of support to go online. So all of your undergraduate, master's degree classes, PhD level classes, seminars, et cetera, those were well supported. But what I found and what a few colleagues of mine found was that non-traditional forms of education really didn't get that support because they weren't on the books. They're not the kind of thing that, you know, the university can even see because they're not being tracked. So we created InStats to support that, to allow people to take their methodological and other forms of expertise and offer it to a global audience online. And it was kind of funny because in the very beginning, we thought, oh, we'll just take workshops online. It'll be simple. Obviously, there's going to be a platform somewhere that will allow us to do that. And so we started looking, and it was pretty amazing. We couldn't find anything that was really designed for our needs. So, you know, we considered various patchwork solutions like, oh, maybe you teach live over Zoom and then get the recordings and put them on YouTube, for example. But, you know, YouTube's sort of the Wild West for, I guess, a wide variety of things, you know, but certainly for high level quantitative research methods training, there's not a lot of quality control there. And then also the monetization model that YouTube has is just not something that is consistent with academic values. You know, they're selling advertisements. You have no control over what those might be. And, you know, obviously Google takes the lion's share of that, of any revenue that your content generates. And so that just didn't seem useful. And it's not a functioning LMS, right? So it's not a learning management system. It doesn't do file hosting. So then we looked at a few other platforms, things like Coursera, you might think would be perfect for this purpose, but actually Coursera doesn't really care about individual academics or researchers at the individual level. Their interest is in partnering with universities. And so there's not really a way for the individual academic to offer content through an organization like Coursera or edX. Instead, what they do is they partner with universities and they offer content that is typically quite sort of general purpose. And they're credentialist in nature, right? So what they're doing is they're offering anybody online pathways to degrees or certifications, et cetera. And there's definitely a place for that. But that's not what academics and researchers want to do when they train each other or, you know, offer content to each other. It is a community-oriented thing, you know, and we want to stay in control of our content. We want to offer what we want to offer, when we want to offer it. And obviously, researchers and academics usually have quite strong opinions on those things. And so what that means is that you have to give them the freedom to create content that covers topics they're interested in a way that they agree with. And so we just didn't find anything online that would suit our needs. So we built it, and that's what InStats is. It combines various things that academics and other researchers need to engage with their communities by offering brief or longer format workshops, short courses, seminars, etc. So we have a learning management system. You know, we do file hosting. We're fully Zoom integrated. I can describe more of its features later, but it allows any academic, any researcher to create an account and offer content for their knowledge community and do so in a way that is consistent, not only with their values, but also with their expectations for what an online platform should be for that purpose. And we know that's true, not only because of the feedback we're getting, but because we're academics. And so we built it really for us, which means we've built it for everybody who's in a similar position trying to engage with their knowledge community. So that's sort of a long-winded way, I guess, of describing my background and a little bit about why we started InStats and how my background relates to that.
So thanks, Michael. So let's just pick at that thread a little bit more. Say more about those features that make InStats unique from the other platforms. And while you're at it, tell us how you came up with the name.
So some of the features that make InStats different than other platforms, I guess I've already touched on a little bit, but to go into greater detail, I mean, one of the things that we've done, which I think is really cool, is we've made content creation extremely easy. And by that, what I mean is, you know, each workshop or each seminar, each short course will get its own webpage. And so on the platform, some of the backend features for our partners, you know, the experts who are on the platform who deliver content, is that almost everything at this point is AI enabled. So we've got ChatGPT-4 integration for drafting new workshop web pages. It takes about 20 seconds and it's quite extensive. You fill in just a little bit of information. We do some intelligent prompting in the back end, and it takes about 20 seconds to create a new workshop webpage. It'll have descriptions. The AI will recommend titles and topics for different sessions that might exist or modules within a workshop. And then you can edit it on the very same webpage where users will go to register. So it's a very intuitive platform for creating the webpages, editing those webpages. And then after the workshop is published, we use AI to generate draft PowerPoint slides. So you never have to start from scratch. I don't know about you, but you know, every once in a while, it's hard to start from nothing to generate something. And so, you know, if you're someone who suffers from that procrastinatory issue, then we've solved it. What we've found, and certainly this is true for me, I'm much better at looking at something I don't like and critiquing it and revising it. You just can't help yourself. If you're an academic, if something is wrong, it's got to be corrected. But if you start from something that's blank, it's just a little more difficult. So anyway, we use AI to create drafts of the web pages. We use AI to create drafts of the PowerPoint slides. You don't have to use those. They're just there integrated into the platform. So that's something that sets us apart. But also, one of the things that really makes us different is that we've integrated academic values into just about everything we do, including the platform and its functionality. So our expert partners who are on the platform, they create any content they'd like, any topics they'd like, any duration they'd like. They set the dates, they set the times, they can control the pricing. They can make it completely free. And at that point, they're just using our platform and our resources, and we're happy to have them do that, sort of a community service that we offer. And they're also always in control of their content. They retain ownership of the intellectual property. We're not trying to replicate the publishing industry's model. And they can pull the content anytime. Now, with the Zoom integration, what that means is that you just set the dates and times. The Zoom meetings are auto-scheduled. And then after a workshop gets published on the platform, you've got a fairly usually substantial amount of time, at least 30 days lead time to finalize the content, get it all uploaded onto the platform. And at that point, we start working with our partners to make sure that the recording environment, because we will record the live stream sessions, that the recording environment is optimized for HD recording. And then after our workshop is over, we have those recordings professionally edited. We do that in-house. We have a group of people who do that internally. They use professional video editing software, including an audio engineer who optimizes the audio. And then after the live streaming session is over, those recordings get turned into an on-demand streaming workshop that is then perpetually available, or available for at least as long as our partner would like it available on the platform. We also allow our partners not only to control the pricing, they can make it free, they can charge for it, et cetera, but they can also make it free for anyone they'd like. So they can whitelist entire email domains. So for example, all of my content on the platform is completely free for everyone at my university, the University of Queensland. So we've incorporated my content into our PhD program a bit. Somebody comes to me, they ask me for help. I say, hey, I've got a workshop on this topic. Go online. It's completely free for you. So, you know, they can also make content free for ASA members if they'd like. So it's a way to, you know, create content, sell that content, or make it free and retain total control and ownership over it. And there's not really another platform on the internet that we've found that will allow researchers, academics to do it, to work like that. In terms of the name Instats, it's just sort of a convenience, really. We started out wondering what would be a good name for an organization that exists outside of a university, but really communicates what we're doing and the level of professionalism and the high level of expertise and knowledge that you can expect to get through us. And we came up with the Institute for Statistical and Data Science. But because that's incredibly difficult to say, certainly repeatedly, and a lot of people will flub it, including me, if I haven't had enough coffee in the morning, we just shortened it to Instats. It's not an acronym, but it's as close as we're going to get.
That's great. So, Michael, can we dig a little bit deeper into the learning experience from the learner's perspective? Do the courses typically have assignments, quizzes, hands-on activities? What's it like for the learner?
That's a great question. So the learner experience is actually highly varied. And the reason why is because the purpose of the platform is to empower researchers and academics to offer content in a style that is consistent with what they think is best. So by prioritizing academic freedom, we allow our partners to do pretty much anything they want. The sessions are theirs to run, or the workshop is theirs to run. As long as it's online, they can do pretty much anything. So for example, what I like to do, because the recordings are of the instructor's camera view and shared screen view, I like to do all of the exercises in sort of demonstration-oriented way during a session that's being recorded. So, and that includes coding, that includes debugging, that includes, you know, generating, maybe it's manipulating data, generating results, interpreting those results, et cetera. And then for exercises, because those aren't really going to be recorded in any kind of compelling way, right? It's not, you're not going to produce compelling on-demand content afterwards with 5 or 10 minute pauses and no recording of what the participants are doing. I'll give a lot of take-home exercises or exercises to do during the breaks. And then there's a lot of discussion around that. So it's actually highly varied. When people offer content that is more theoretical in nature, as you can imagine, it's a little more discussion-oriented. They're doing less coding, there are less results being generated, et cetera. But if somebody wants to do something that involves a lot of exercises, a lot of hands-on work, et cetera, they can also do that. So the key for us is to work with our partners to ensure that the description of their workshop or the content they're offering is accurate. So as long as participants know what they're getting themselves into, then everything is completely fine. So there's a lot of variation there. And the variation is consistent with the varied interests of the individuals who make up the knowledge communities who are represented on our platform. So the academics and experts. So you might enroll in a workshop, and as long as you know what you're getting yourself into, right, it could be totally theoretical. Or you might enroll in a workshop and you'll be fine with that. You might enroll in a workshop and know that from the second it gets started, what you're going to be doing is working with data. You're in R, maybe you're in Python, maybe you're in something else. And so that's really the key for us, just giving people the freedom to do what they think is right and best, and making sure that everyone who enrolls in those workshops understands what they're getting themselves into.
That's great. So let's go down that road as well. So I'm an ASA member, and I've heard about this, and I want to get online and take a course. So walk us through the experience that I would need to have from signing up all the way through completing a course.
Yeah, it's a great question. So for ASA members, it works in a similar way to everyone else. There's one little variation there, which is a benefit to ASA members. And the first thing that anyone will do is create an InStats user account if they don't already have one. That only takes about 10 seconds. During the account creation process, one question that gets asked is whether or not people are a member of a professional association or society. The ASA is in our database. And so if somebody says that they're an ASA member, then we do a very quick database query. We're not sharing private information, obviously, with anyone. And we're not asking the ASA to share any of its member information with us. But during the account creation process, if someone says that they're an ASA member, we can confirm that. And then they get an automatic 30% discount on all fee-based InStats content. And then obviously that allows us also to whitelist their account so that they can take any content that is free for ASA members. They also get that for free. And after a user account creation, they will confirm their email address, and then the enrollment process is extremely easy. So for any free content, and we have quite a bit of free content, you know, free introduction to R, free introduction to some software package, a free introduction to some technique or method, those are usually quite brief, an hour, 2 hours, something like that. They can just click register, and then they're automatically registered. So that takes about 2 seconds. If you're going to enroll in fee-based content, then you just click register, we will redirect to our credit card processor, and then your enrollment begins in that moment. So we have two different kinds of offerings. So if you're going to enroll in an upcoming live streaming seminar, which takes place on some particular date, you enroll obviously ahead of time and then show up on the day. And you can just click the Zoom link and you'll be taken directly into the meeting. It is a regular Zoom meeting. So you can see the person who's delivering the content. You can talk to them. You can ask them questions. You can use the chat function. And you can do this knowing that we're not going to record your camera view. So for the live sessions, it works like that. Now you can miss the live session and still engage with the content asynchronously. We get the recordings. We process those as quickly as we can. It's usually within 12 hours. And then they're up on the site, ready for viewing. Participants have 30 days of access to those recordings for any live workshop. And there's also an expert moderated Q&A forum. So even if you can't make it, and we're a very global organization, so we have lots of people enrolling in workshops that happen 3 a.m., 4 a.m. for them. So they're engaging with the content asynchronously. There's 30 days of access to that. After that, the workshop will transition into the on-demand streaming space. So if you're registering for one of those workshops, it's actually pretty cool the way we've set this up, partly to account for the fact that academics quite often will have grant or other sorts of funds that expire at the end of some calendar year or academic year. If you enroll in an on-demand workshop, you pay for enrollment, and then you can activate 30 days of access anytime over the next 2 years. And you can enroll anyone you want. You can enroll yourself, you can enroll a colleague, or maybe a student of yours. And then they will have 2 years in which they can activate their enrollment. After enrollment activation, they have 30 days of access. Now, there's still a Q&A forum for the on-demand streaming content, but it is not necessarily instructor moderated. So it becomes a lot more passive. It's also less expensive. So that's sort of what the enrollment and content access experience is. Apart from that, it is a normal Zoom meeting when you're in the live session. So whatever our expert partners want to do in that space, that's what gets done.
That's really remarkable. Just a quick follow-up. So I'm signed up and maybe I'm looking for a particular thing to be trained in, or maybe I just want to see what's there. Could you just say briefly how we go about locating the content that I might want as somebody registered for InStats?
Well, just go to our landing page, instats.org, and then scroll down under the seminars heading, which is the first thing that you'll see. And from here, the first thing that you'll see is you'll see chronologically listed our upcoming live streaming workshops. Now, you can filter and sort by clicking a button on the right, filter and sort. And then you can not only sort by date, you can sort by various other things. You can sort by instructor, you can sort by price, et cetera. You can also search. So all of the individual sessions within a workshop or a seminar, so maybe it is, you know, a three-day workshop. It has three separate sessions per day. A session is like a class, right? So it runs continuously with no breaks. Those are usually anywhere from about 40 minutes up to about 2 hours if you like to torture people. And so, but again, it's at the expert's discretion. So when you do the search for content, what you're actually searching is you're searching the topics and keywords associated with each session in a workshop. So when someone creates content and they say what's going to be covered in a given session, anytime somebody does a search for content on our platform under the seminars heading on the landing page, they're actually searching through the searchable topics and keywords. So you can search for those for live seminars that are coming up. And you can also search, do a search or filter and sort our on-demand library. And at this point, we've got over 150 workshops in the on-demand streaming space. As I said, some of those are free. Many of them are fee-based and offered by leading experts in their areas. So you can find the content that you're after. And then obviously after the workshop card shows up under the seminars heading on the landing page, then you can click it and get additional details.
Obviously, we're super excited about the InStats ASA partnership, and we hope our members are getting more excited as they're listening to this podcast. But to just add to that enthusiasm, what are some of the most popular existing courses?
It's a great question. And it's sort of interesting because when InStats started, you know, this new natural language oriented AI revolution had not yet happened. ChatGPT obviously being the most well-known example of that, but it has certainly happened by now. So what we've seen over time is a shift in the nature of the content that people are offering and what is popular. Now, there are some core topics that I think are always going to be popular and certainly are popular on our platform. And those are related to causal inference. So this is such an important aspect of science and scientific practice that, you know, we've been obsessed with it for hundreds of years, going back to, Bishop Berkeley's famous statement that correlation does not necessarily imply causation in the 1700s. So that is still a very popular topic, and it is of great interest. So we've got some content by Jeff Wooldridge, who's a very well-known econometrician, on causal inference with cross-sectional data, difference in differences methods with longitudinal panel data, et cetera. So those are popular topics. But with this AI revolution, what we've also seen is a lot of content being generated by our partners on how to incorporate ChatGPT into research workflows and in ethical ways, I want to emphasize, not necessarily just how to get ChatGPT to write your grant applications and papers for you, but what is this technology? How can we put it to use in good faith? How can we use it, for example, to write Python code? How can we use it to write R code? How can we use it to make our research workflows more efficient and maybe do some internal informal reviews of manuscripts, papers, et cetera? Well, again, doing that in good faith, not just relying on it to write papers de novo, for example, which would not be in good faith, but how to use it and understand its limitations and its capabilities and really use it as a research assistant. That's why it's here in our view, and it's not going away. So those workshops that incorporate new AI methods are quite popular. That is true in the live and in the on-demand space. So we've got traditional topics that are of interest, and we've got new and emerging areas of what ends up actually being research methods oriented in the AI space that end up being quite popular.
You've said a lot about the instructor experience. So get the creative juices of the very talented ASA members flowing. What topics would you really like to see developed by ASA members as possible courses?
Right. That's an interesting question. And it's one that I get asked a lot by new experts when they come onto the platform. What do you think I should do? What kind of content should I offer? You know, that sort of thing. And the answer that I almost always give is, well, what do you love? What are you passionate about? Because we built this platform as a means to expressing, you know, yourself and your passions and your interests to other members of your research community. So sometimes what people are passionate about is generating some revenue for themselves. You know, sometimes they want to take their families on vacation or whatever their interests are. And we understand that as an interest. So in that case, offering content that is going to appeal to the broadest cross-section of people, maybe across disciplines, et cetera, is going to be of interest. And so, you know, what those topics are going to be, as I said, things that are of interest to a wide variety of different knowledge-oriented communities, things like causal inference, et cetera. But sometimes what we get, and again, this is something I think we can all relate to as scholars. In fact, so I'll just give you an example. I won't say who, obviously, but I had a conversation with somebody the other day who asked that question. And I said, well, what are you passionate about? And this person said, missing data. And I said, okay, great. You know, that's a very important topic for a variety of reasons. And he said, no. Missing data is never treated appropriately, ever. And I said, okay, wow. That's obviously we're getting into something, you know, that is personally very, very meaningful. And he said, the way that we handle missing data is almost always based on an abstract theory of the mechanisms that have generated the missing data, but we almost never have good evidence for that. So when we come into these kinds of situations where almost everything we do is theory-based, how do we act? How do we behave as methodologists? And that's what the workshop needs to be about. And I said, okay, we talked a little bit more about that. It was something that this person was very passionate about. And then he said, I think I might only be able to get 5 or 10 people into a room to listen to me talk about this. Is that okay? And I said, that is perfectly fine with us. We completely understand passion-driven scholarship and forms of communication. That is an incredibly important part of what it is to be a researcher, a scholar, an academic. So if there's something that you love or you think the community needs to hear about, even if you're not going to be able to generate a lot of interest, we're here to support it. You know, that's why we built the platform, so that knowledge-oriented communities can talk to each other. If you're going to allow them to do that in a way that is not tied so directly to market-oriented interests that it ruins the process of scholarly discussion, then what you need to do is you need to have a platform like InStats where people can generate their own content on any topic anytime they want. We're not here to control that. We're here to let you and your knowledge community sort of self-generate content that you think is important.
So thanks for that. Put your prediction hat on. No worries, because nobody's going to hold you to the answers.
Okay.
You talked earlier about the disruption that the pandemic created in terms of education. We haven't had very many disruptions like that one, but we've had disruptive events in education. Maybe you were in graduate school. I don't know. Maybe you were even an undergraduate. I have no idea, but I'm sure you remember MOOCs. And by golly, everybody needed to have one. And I don't remember the last time I actually heard that word. It came and then it changed. And so now we've entered this new landscape where InStats is possible because there's technology, Zoom, and there's innovation that's supplied by you and your colleagues. And you're building a platform for now, but you're also building a platform to last. What do you see ahead and how are you trying to get ready for that?
It's a great question. So the MOOC word is an interesting one to bring up here, because as you rightly said, you can't remember the last time you heard that. But for a while, it was everywhere. It was being bandied about. It was revolutionary. But the innovation was only technological. in my view, it was primarily technological. It wasn't social and it wasn't institutional. So to create change, you have to combine those things, right? You need changing institutions, changing relationships among people who constitute knowledge communities and who are tasked with disseminating that knowledge to people who, at least in the university space, want training. They want sometimes a degree, obviously, quite often. So any revolution cannot merely be technological. It has to incorporate other important elements. So consistent with what you've said, what really changed as a function of the pandemic, because Zoom existed before that. I mean, heck, you even had Skype long, long before that. So the technology in theory was there. Obviously, that technology has been modified and increasingly perfected for the uses that it's been put to ever since the pandemic occurred and everybody went online. But the real innovation or change has been the legitimacy of online education. So before the pandemic, you couldn't run in the same way that you can now, purely online forms of education, and have people look at that and say, that will constitute a university degree. But here in Australia, for example, almost all of the universities have gone online. And I mean, they are not running in-person classes, which is wild, right? You have only the highest ranked universities still running on a regular basis in-person classes in physical spaces. So that is a massive shift. And the technology enables it, but the change is really social and it's institutional. It's material as well, obviously, because those buildings are now being repurposed where they used to run those classes, et cetera. So they couldn't even go back to in-person education because they're fundamentally transforming the structure of their universities, including physical spaces. So what's going to happen next? If the physical space is no longer going to be a limiting factor, then the position of the university, I think, is going to change to some extent. And people have been talking about this for a long time. Technology, MOOCs, right? Technology is going to change everything. But what has really changed it is the pandemic and the legitimacy of online forms of education. So what's happening at the same time, though, are a couple of other forces or technological and other contributions to what I think is going to be a monumental shift in the next 20 or 30 years. And the first thing is artificial intelligence. So AI methods are going to get increasingly good at predicting what people might say next without lying. And so they're not great yet, but they're getting better and better, and they're doing so very quickly. And so, as I said, our platform is already AI integrated. It generates the web pages, it generates drafts of your PowerPoint slides. And as that technology gets better and better, educators are going to increasingly rely on it for various things. And just to touch on this point and hopefully allay some concerns, not all concerns, because there are some substantial concerns with AI that are very legitimate, but to allay some concerns about incorporating AI into the educational process, in my view, it is just the next phase of distributed human cognition. You know, if you've got a calculator, that's distributed cognition. If you've got a sextant and you're navigating by the stars, that is distributed human cognition. It's not just happening in the head. It is a material external thing when people think. We think with tools. That is just a feature of being human. And so we've been doing that for a very long time. And AI is the next revolution in what we've been doing all along, just distributed cognition. It happens in our heads. It's a social thing. It's a material thing. And so AI is here, hopefully, to help us do various important things, including educate each other and ourselves. So AI is going to be integrated into the teaching and learning process. It already is. And then, you know, the minute you start eliminating physical spaces in universities where people are going to be educated, relying more on non-university sources of expertise and education, I think becomes a real possibility, unlike what happened with MOOCs. That didn't change the need to go to a university to get your education. But the minute you start displacing students from the physical spaces, then all of a sudden the university, I think, becomes more dislodged as the primary source of, maybe not the primary, but the only source of legitimate forms of expertise and education. And then the third thing is that, you know, deep learning and AI will not only be used for teaching and learning, it will be used for research. increasingly incorporated into research methods curricula and used for things like prediction. And that is actually very, very substantial because a lot of what we'll do will become not model-based. It will become outcome-based. So instead of relying on, for example, statistical models for various forms of inference, and I guess, I mean, everything is still sort of model-based, but what AI does and deep learning methods do, as you would know, is they create models that are not really interpretable. You know, they're not explainable. And so once we get comfortable with those, and we're slowly getting comfortable with those, I think that that's going to transform the way that we understand research, research methods, and therefore what we teach our graduate students. If you can just AI all sorts of things, then coming up with the right model is no longer something that we should all be interested in. Everyone, of course, listening to this would know the well-known adage, all models are wrong, but some are useful. Well, in many cases, the most useful model is going to be something that you couldn't explain even if you wanted to moving forward. So that's sort of where I see things going. It's the shifts are technological, but they're social, they're institutional. And InStats is one indicator of that, I think, some of those transitions and changes that are taking place.
Michael, we really appreciate the conversation about InStats and look forward to many more conversations. So as we're coming to an end of the podcast, we always like to ask our guests what they're reading, listening to, watching, playlists, other podcasts. We're happy to give some shout outs to other podcasts. So what's on your TBR?
Well, right now, and actually this is a great time to ask this question because the New York Times just released its, I think the New York Times Book Review Top 100 Novels of the 21st Century. It's probably everybody's seen that. So I went through that and pulled out a few things that looked like they'd be good to read, and those are all being delivered as we speak. But apart from that, right now, I'm revisiting some Henry James novels, obviously one of the best known authors of the 20th and 19th century, and add the brother of William James. So as a classical American pragmatist, you know, I've always liked the work of William James. And my better half and I are watching Breaking Bad again. So that's sort of a guilty pleasure. We revisit that whenever work becomes overwhelming, just to remind ourselves that our lives aren't so bad.
That's great. Well, again, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us. And Ron and I look forward to our listeners sharing their passions with us as we develop the InStats partnership. But as is another tradition, I will turn it over to my colleague, Ron, for his top 10.
Thank you, Donna. Well, it's August, and that means JSM. And JSM means growing as a professional. The joint statistical meetings are loaded with continuing education and professional development opportunities, and you should engage with them if you can. But alas, not all the ideas for professional development that we receive are the best ideas. So in our relentless efforts to improve the lives of our listeners, the Practical Significance Podcast presents the top 10 rejected professional development course ideas. Don't sign up for courses like these, listeners. Number 10, the lone wolf statistician, collaboration is for losers. Number 9, writing your own Yelp reviews. Number 8, using transparencies for your presentations. This one comes with a mini course on fax usage. Number 7, speaking with your back to the audience and other skills for the shy statistician. Number 6, MCMC on your TI-83, sure you can. Number 5, making your convenient samples even more convenient. Number 4, 6 easy ways to make your AI-generated work look like you did it. Number 3, how to have opinions on things you know nothing about. Number 2, keeping those healthy impulses in check. And the number 1 rejected professional development course idea, living the Ron Wasserstein way. Well, that's it for this episode of Practical Significance. Join us next month as we continue the conversation.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Practical Significance, the podcast of the American Statistical Association. A new episode will be coming your way next month from AmStat News, the ASA's monthly membership magazine.